what makes a communication really great and successful?
We're living in a world where there is so much noise, things that don't matter to anyone and that come up one day, have a one day peak and then disappear again. And when you are working at a company, such a big company, you have to make sure that you don't add to that noise.
Yeah. What's going on in the world, Barbara? How do you view that? It's crazy, you know? It's all about communication, but communication has changed.
I don't know if it's all about communication. It's also about facts, creating facts. People are concerned about what's going on. So am I. I think we are in a situation where the beliefs after the Second World War period are not the same anymore. So I grew up in a world where democracy was a given. There was a clear other system there where you could see that this is not developing well and broke them down.
If we think through the global scenario, all the possible reasons to experience fear, right, with the wars going on, what would you say could be the hope we see?
So first of all, nothing lasts forever.
Huh? Yeah.
You should never exclude that other people are capable to learn as well.
Yeah. Huh?
But what I was talking about was your individual decision. I think we cannot wait until the big problems are being solved.
Yeah.
We need to do something in our own surrounding.
Hi, this is Christoph and welcome to the podcast Learning from Leaders. I'm happy that you're here today. This is the podcast, as you know, where you look behind the scenes, learn more about leaders who made it to the top, understand what was the key to their success, when did they fall, and most importantly, how did they get up again? And I'm so happy to have today with me a real expert on communication, a great leader, a person I admire personally, Barbara Schädler. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much, Christoph. Thanks for having me here.
Yes, I look much forward to this dialogue to discuss with you. You are an expert on communication, so
I hope at least after 35 years in the job.
So it's going to be very interesting to discuss. And let me aim to at least introduce some of what you have done in your professional life, and that's a lot, as we know. It's definitely fair to say that you're one of the most established communication experts in the corporate field in the world. And over the last years, you have shaped the way of some of the most leading organizations in the world. I can name Lufthansa, Aon, SAP, Fuji, Siemens, or the German Federal Ministry of Finance. And most recently, you have served as the head of group communications at Roche, guiding the company through really very interesting, challenging, transformational times. But I would like to say, I think what makes you so special is not just what you have done, but also how you have done it. I've gotten to know you, I've seen you in action, and I've seen that there is a real interesting, intriguing, honest, genuine spirit that drives you, and I'm looking forward to get to know you in more detail in this conversation. I would like to start by establishing that since 2020, every single year, you have been named as one of the top 100 experts in communication globally. That's an incredible achievement, Barbara. Congratulations to that. I think Roche can be very proud of that, and you can be very proud of that. And so I want to ask you, what makes a communication really great and successful?
First of all, we're living in a world where there is so much noise, such an incredible amount of noise. Things that don't matter to anyone, right? And that come up one day, have a one day peak and then disappear again. And when you are working at a company, such a big company at Roche as I did up until recently, you have to make sure that you don't add to that noise.
Yeah.
So I strongly believe that less is more, but that the things that you do must be really spot on and think about the audiences more than what you want to say. You know, what you need to translate what you want to say in something that someone wants to hear. And for a global company, it is a big number of people that want to hear what you say. Specifically for Roche, which is a company, very successful company in the healthcare sector.
Absolutely.
And what is closer to people than their own health,
yeah,
right? It's pretty easy to find the right topics, but how do you get across the noise in the world is what is always driving me.
And I think there's more noise, as you say, than ever before. I mean, research says that all of you and me, all of us out there who are listening to the podcast every day, we experience about 6,000 thoughts. I think that's quite some traffic jam up there in our head. There's also noise out there with all the social media, with the communication. And if I reflect on what you just said, it's about not just sharing what you want to say, but really translating it in a language that is relevant, understandable for the other. Now, that seems to be clear when you and me, we are conversing right now.
Can I say something to what you said about this flow of information that is coming to us every day?
Yeah.
I think this is one of the real, real problems we are facing in the world, and one of the problems why so many democracies are struggling right now with pretty extreme views of people, which really concerns me, because I do believe that people are just disconnecting from what's going on because they can't handle it anymore. And try to simplify a very complex world. Unfortunately, simplifying a complex world doesn't work, because the world still remains complex. And then you disconnect in a way, and then you tend to more focus on your own beliefs that are not very fact-based, and that makes things really difficult.
And I think all of us, we have that phenomena and the challenge that we just can't understand all that is going on in the world. And when it's just too complex, sometimes we experience stress, and that makes us reactive, and we go back to kind of our foundational beliefs, which has not much to do with the world. Would you say that's true?
And the focus then on specific platforms or channels that reflect my own opinion instead of being open for other people's view is a big problem.
It's a big problem. And right there, from a corporate communication, we have moved to really the global platform, and also to politics. And maybe we can dive into that as it is here with us on the table. What's going on in the world, Barbara? How do you view that? It's crazy, you know? It's all about communication, but communication has changed. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I don't know if it's all about communications. It's also about facts, right? You know, people are creating facts, and many people are concerned about what's going on. So am I, in a way. I think we are in a situation where the beliefs after the Second World War period are not the same anymore. So I grew up in a world where democracy was a given. There was a clear other system there, where you could see that this is not developing well, and broke then down in the east of Europe. And now people are looking to a time where things become easier. I'm not quite sure if that's going to happen. I think we need to get adjusted to a world that remains complex, and is going to probably be even more complex. I just hope that we're not going to go far and beyond everything that people can live with. So the biggest concern that is all over the place is war, right? And would we have imagined 10 years ago that we would live in a world where war is happening in Ukraine and in other parts of the world, so close, and somehow we get used to live with it, but people are really scared about this, for good reasons. I would say we must remember that we can solve the problems of the world just in dialogue. If we believe that, if, you know, take myself, if I believe that I'm right, I'm already wrong. I can only express my beliefs, but I need to remain open for other people's thoughts. And that is what drives innovation, what drives new ideas. So if I'm not capable to listen anymore to other people, I'm not going to learn anything. But it is very important that we stay open and learn from each other and respect other people's views. This is, I think, something that I miss today a lot.
It's being missed. I definitely miss that too. And I mean, the foundation of a good communication, and also when we want to resolve a conflict, I think, is that sincere quest for a truth, that authenticity, and also that aim to live up to certain values, maybe even global values. Do you see eradication of those values?
Not of the values, but about the acceptance.
Yeah,
the values still remain. But I have a problem with the word truth, with the word truth. You know, what kind of truth are we talking about? I have my truth, you have your truth. This is what I mean. My truth can be right or wrong.
Yes.
And I need to be open to other people's thoughts to reflect whether I'm right or wrong.
Yeah.
And I need to change my opinion once in a while. And I actually have strong opinions, but still need to be open to reflect whether I'm right or wrong.
Yeah. Now, you said that good communication is the ability to not just share what you think, feel, or what you want to communicate, but do that in a way that is understandable and acceptable, palatable for the other person. And when we, the two of us, talk together, that's a concept which is quite easy to grasp. Now, you, though, have been communicating with the whole world, right, in your organizations. And therefore, the world is your client, and as you just explained, everybody's so different. The mental maps of all of us are so different.
Yeah, but
how
but
to solve that riddle?
You don't. You know, the things that you communicate on the global level are the really important corporate topics, yeah, right? Or the really important product topics. Most of our communication is happening in across the world with the affiliate communicators that, yeah, know their countries, that know that culture, that know how to communicate to their people and to their audiences, to their customers, to their partners, to the patients, yeah, whatsoever. So I don't have the ambition to say European or Western communication is the right thing. I do believe that you really need to understand who the people are you want to talk to. And I, for sure, don't understand people in India or in China, yeah, or in Japan or in Brazil or wherever in the world as good as our colleagues or as my former colleagues at Roche in those countries.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just not possible.
Yeah. Now, Barbara, it took us about 3 minutes to start to talk about communication on a global level, not just in the corporate world, but really in terms of politics. We talked about war. And I think that shows your level of responsibility you have been taking, your mindset, how vast your thinking and your acting is. And I would like to understand, was that always like that? And if you would now imagine that we would interview your parents back when you were maybe 14, 15, 16 years old. Would they have said, yes, that's Barbara and she will be a global communicator and a leader? Or was that natural to you?
No, probably not. When I was 14 or 15, yeah, I think I was a pretty horrible kid. Huh?
Okay.
So I wasn't
What
really,
made you a horrible kid?
I wasn't really interested in school, you know. Okay. I thought that was really boring.
So we have something in common.
I took school more like a social event and said, I'm going to meet my friends there. Looking backwards, which was probably not the smartest decision I've, yeah, ever taken in my life. But I grew up in a household. My father was a regional politician.
Okay.
So I was always connected to politics throughout my whole life and lots of discussions and, yeah, and also very energetic discussions at home already. And the other thing that was pretty significant for me, I grew up with three brothers.
Okay.
And I have no sister.
Yeah.
So I understand from my first day in life how men act.
Yeah.
Huh? Which made my life probably a little bit easier, yeah, throughout my whole career because, yeah, that was not a discussion at all.
Yeah. Because most of the boardrooms that you have worked in were dominated still by...
Yeah, but it was not just boardrooms. That was the other thing. I started my communications career at the Federal Ministry of Finance,
yeah,
in Germany.
Yeah.
And I was actually very young. I think it was at the age of 32. I was serving the Federal Minister of Finance, whose name is Theo Weigel.
Is incredible. Barbara, take us there. So at 15, 16, you're going to school just to socialize. And at 32, you're serving Theo Weigel and the German Federal Ministry. I mean, what happened in between?
So in the meantime, after school, I didn't really know what to do. I went to a bank and did a 3 years phase in the bank, which I found at that point in time not totally exciting either. And then I went to study, mm-hmm, and I figured pretty fast out that studying economics is my thing because it's the combination of logical thinking, mm-hmm, politics, assumptions, having opinions, unfortunately also mathematics, which was not my strength. But you can learn anything if you want. And there I started to really work hard, really, because, yeah, it was interesting. I knew why I'm going to do that. And I also am pretty competitive. So I wanted to show that when I want, I can achieve anything.
Yeah.
So I actually, throughout this process, I went to one of the consultants that are always available at universities. What should I do? I don't really know. And she looked at my papers and she said, you should not study anything that is related to mathematics, because I was so bad, so bad in school. And then I thought, let's wait and see. I can manage that. I can manage.
So you were challenged.
Yes, I was challenged, and I love being challenged.
Yeah.
It actually brings up my energy, and competition is always good.
Huh? Yeah. So you got challenged. There was also purposefulness. Is what I hear also, and you started to work real hard. Working hard. How did that look like?
It looked like in the 2 years before I did my master in university, I think I just worked to I really wanted to succeed. And for example, I'm coming from a wine region. My father's family had vineyards. So do we now, but in that, I think in the year before the master, I didn't drink a drop of alcohol. No wine, no nothing. Because it would have just reduced my brain power. And I wanted to get up in the morning, 8 o'clock until probably 8 o'clock in the evening, and just get to know what I need to know to be pretty sure when I pass the exam that it's going to be brilliant.
Wow. So a real corporate athlete, with lots of discipline. And it paid off. It paid off. You got this opportunity. How did that come about? I mean,
my first job?
Yeah.
My first job came in the Federal Ministry of Finance. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was pretty lucky, because they were looking for an economist to help them prepare G7 summits. And they actually asked my professor if he knows someone. And he said, talk to her. And I got the job. But I started there as an economist. And a year later, they asked me whether I would like to become a spokesperson. And I had figured out until then that hierarchy is probably not what I really love. When you're working in a public administration and you get started there, it was actually, I think, 6 or 7 hierarchy levels until the top of the organization.
Okay,
That's hard.
Yeah.
That's hard, right? Because everything gets rewritten, everything gets checked several times. What you have done is not really visible at all anymore. And then I got the offer of becoming a spokesperson. And as a spokesperson, there were only 5 in this ministry. Yeah. And you work directly with the highest hierarchies of the organization.
Yeah.
And I found that really exciting.
Wow. Hmm? Yeah. What a chance. At 32, you are there with the highest levels in.
Yeah, it was also related to crisis communication, which is, I don't know if you know that, crisis communication is, a red thread through my life.
Yeah.
And I think crisis communication is actually a red thread through almost any communicator's life.
Yeah.
I was on a Friday afternoon at times where there were no mobile phones available. You can hardly imagine that time, right? I don't know if you ever lived there. I came back to the office just to pick up my bag, because I was out with a couple of colleagues.
Yeah.
And the phone rang. And I picked up the phone, and I had the minister on the phone, who said, did you see the headline of this and that newspaper? I was the only one in the office. And I said, I didn't see that, because it's being published in Munich earlier than it's being published in Bonn.
Yeah.
So what does it say? And it was a really heavy attack on him.
Yeah.
And the reason why I then didn't care about anything else but that crisis in close collaboration with him was that I was there in the office. That was all. So there was nothing planned, nothing prepared. It was just I was the only available person. Okay. And that drove my career quite a lot.
So you were there? And so you took responsibility.
He said, you're going to do, in the next couple of weeks, you're going to do nothing else
but
taking care of this case.
Yes. Yeah. So what
made... And I was successful, by the way.
You were successful.
Yeah.
I can very well imagine that. I think we all go through crisis. The world goes through multiple crises at the same time. What makes crisis communication successful? What would you say is the key?
First of all, I think it's good when you calm down.
Yeah.
In times of crisis, getting things done, but getting things done at the right level of speed.
Yeah.
Everyone around you usually is turning crazy. And if you as a communicator then join that group of craziness, then you're not going to succeed because you have to take many, many, many decisions in very short term.
Yeah.
And you need to be really sure that these decisions you're taking are right. So take the time to take the right decisions and then act consistently. You know, I can give a lecture about crisis communications, which will then last for 12 hours.
Yes.
I think empathy is one of the core competencies in crisis communications because it's not enough to talk about the facts, to clarify the facts. You have to always imagine what is the impact on other people.
Yeah.
What is the impact of reactions of the corporate organization or the company on other people? How is it going to be perceived? How do you make sure that people understand that on the other side are also human beings and not just organizations? How do you make sure that you're taking serious in your own concerns and that you take the concerns of everyone else also serious?
Yeah.
And then consistency. Make sure that everyone who talks on behalf of an organization says the same thing to the same topic.
Yeah.
That is fundamental.
Now, very interestingly, you said that in the crisis, and I think it's quite naturally, everybody starts running, But as a crisis communicator, you need to calm down. Is that something, would you say, that has been part of your nature or you train?
It's me.
It's you.
It's me, yes. You know, I have this, I figured out that this is good because it avoids making too many mistakes. And you don't have you don't have the opportunity to make too many mistakes because, let's say, either all media in a region or all media in a country or even all media in the world are watching you, what you're doing. And mistakes are actually under these circumstances, not possible.
Yeah.
Not possible.
For me, it seems, Barbara, almost that is not just important for crisis communication, but all it seems to me a meta competency for every leader because the pressure is such that we are tempted to run constantly. But if you want to run in the right direction and change direction, we need to remain calm, right? To remain aware of ourselves, of the order, to have empathy, to understand the context, to then be, let's say, agile and kind of do the right thing. And he said, then you need to do the right thing. And would you say that's a function of head and heart? Is that a function also of intuition?
This is very much a function of intuition because when you get started without any experience, without any preparation, then you're going to not succeed. You probably know that I was working at Lufthansa when the German Wings crash happened.
That would be so interesting to learn more. That was 2015, isn't it?
It's now 10 years ago, almost.
And I think we all remember where we were when we saw that on television, right? It's really one of these moments for at least the German-speaking, maybe European population. Yeah. Where were you when that happened? I mean, how
in
did
the
you
office. Get to I was know? In the okay. office. Luckily, I was in the office.
You were in the office.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, that was bigger than anything before, probably, that you had experienced in terms of crisis.
That was sadder than anything before and horrific in a way, you know, because when you are working in an airline company, the highest value you have is bringing people from place one to place two in a safe way.
Yeah.
And we didn't succeed.
Yeah.
For whatever reason,
You
know, the thing is, you know, what I really admire in the airline industry and probably specifically with Lufthansa, the level of preparation that airliners have for such crisis is incredible. I've never seen before and after anything close to that.
Yeah.
Nowhere. Mm. Yeah. And I would recommend many, many companies to have a closer look at their crisis communications processes because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. You just don't know.
Yeah.
And there are so many examples that people do not succeed in crisis. Yeah. You know, I I can remember so many crises where I was just shaking my head and saying, ah. For example, let me give you a concrete example. You in every crisis, there's the first press conference.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what you see in many cases that someone who speaks on behalf of the company appears, makes a statement, turns around and goes away.
Yeah.
I think that is totally embarrassing.
Mm.
Totally embarrassing. Because you need to take the, I strongly believe you need to take the opportunity to connect with people already.
Yeah.
So you cannot, at the beginning, you probably cannot run a fully fledged press conference because you don't know enough to do that. But you can allow a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can also make sure that people understand that you're going to be as transparent as possible, that you're going to be as available as possible, that
yeah.
you're going to disclose things once you know them, be open, be transparent,
yeah.
and make sure that people understand that you're interested in their thoughts, in their feelings, in their requests.
Yeah. So establishing that trust also,
yes.
and that sense of security in the population or in the people who are concerned. Is that what you did? Now, when we go back to 2015, you sit in the office, you see that crash, a Eurowings airplane actually crashing in the mountains, and then I mean, what's next? I mean, you have experienced.
First of all, it is not me who does that,
yeah.
right? It is
yeah.
it is the whole team.
Yeah,
you know, the most impressive thing this day was that I had an office with a glass around.
Yeah,
and while I was working on the first social media post, I saw that. The whole team came back, those who were pregnant, those who were
wow.
sick, those who were
yeah.
On holidays, they all came back.
Yeah.
And my most important job as the leader of a team is leading the team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very
that
true.
That is what you do as a leader
yeah.
and not believe that you can do anything significantly
yeah.
Significant without leading that team.
Yeah.
So it was actually the team who did the job, not
yeah.
myself.
So you start.
So you make sure that the
yeah.
team knows what to do,
yeah.
and that is enabled what to do. And I don't know if you've ever seen that when you are running a communications team, you distribute new jobs when a significant event happens.
Yeah.
So there's a plan. You create. At the same split second, new jobs that haven't been before, like someone who organizes everything.
Yeah.
You know, we went at Lufthansa to 24/7 shifts for 6 weeks. We didn't have shift plans before. Someone
yeah.
needs to do the shift plans,
yeah.
right? And you need to build a call center in 5 minutes because the whole world press is calling you.
Yeah.
Lufthansa, we were prepared to do that, right? And my colleagues did it.
Yeah, your colleagues did it. I think that's a common dilemma as a leader. In crisis situations or when it gets tough, there could be the risk that I or you as a leader, we start doing, we put our head down and get into action, but we forget to lead the team, which is the main responsibility we have. Is that something you had to remind yourself of?
No.
That came natural to you?
No. You know, I am. I think I figured out in the Federal Ministry of Finance that my passion in the job is leading teams
yeah.
and doing communications. These are the two things I always wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that is pretty consistent throughout my whole career. And,
yeah.
and this is what really drives me and what is most exciting to
yeah.
me.
And we know today that many case studies have been written up exactly about the way you handled the communication at that time. It's a best practice in the world.
I don't know. You know, it's not just achievement. It is also being lucky. You know, there's lots of
no
things
doubt.
That need to come
yeah.
together. And I you know, even the idea of saying, okay, this is a best case thing, you know, this is a worst case thing, actually, right?
Yeah.
And
it remains.
Hmm?
It
yeah.
remains. However, if we would like to learn from it, what I heard you saying is that communicate early, communicate with empathy, even if you don't know maybe share what
you know. Be transparent.
Then take care of your team, because that's the responsibility as a head. What would be maybe two, three other aspects which you would say made that so successful? We have that factor of luck.
You continue to name it successful. Transparency.
Yeah.
Openness.
Yeah.
Admitting that you don't know everything.
Yeah.
And probably most importantly, think about those who have lost loved ones.
Yeah.
That is probably the leading thing for everyone in such a situation. Yeah. As soon as human life is affected, you have to think about how does this land with the people who are suffering so much right now.
Yeah. Mm. Acting out of that compassion then as a guiding principle.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think a couple of years later, you then moved 2019, I believe, to Roche. And life said to itself, well, Barbara can handle even more. We can say now.
Crisis.
Crisis. But it wasn't funny, right? What happened in the early 2020, in the early months of 2020, COVID came and you were there leading the ship. How was that, Barbara?
Yeah, that was for me like for everyone else in the world. You know, we are just shaking our heads, and many of us, I think most of us, were really afraid because we didn't know what's going on. And then at Roche specifically, you know, Roche delivers diagnostics and medicines for very severe diseases. Very severe diseases. So you probably remember that flights were stopped. You couldn't go anywhere anymore. And I really admire how the colleagues at Roche did continue to keep the supply chain up and running, and how they kept the production up and running, and how they continued driving development so that there was no disruption. You know, imagine you are sitting somewhere, you have cancer, you get a treatment that cannot be disrupted.
Yeah.
You know, the responsibility of such a company is make sure your patients get wherever they are what they need.
Yeah.
And then we had the diagnostics colleagues who, I think Roche was the first company who brought a COVID test to market.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the COVID tests really made a difference because up until then, you had cold symptoms. You didn't know whether it's a normal cold. You didn't know whether it's anything you need to be concerned about. And then the tests came in, and then you had a pretty high security on knowing what you have, and you could isolate yourself until the vaccines kicked in, right? And I have to say, the way this was handled at Roche was exemplary. Was outstanding. Outstanding, really,
What made it so outstanding?
Yeah, you know, the whole team kept going.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we all did that sitting at home, or let's say, not all sitting at home. Development you can't do at home, you cannot produce at home, and you cannot run a supply chain from home. So they did it. They kept on going.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was incredible.
It was an incredible time. And Barbara, I do remember, you know, as a Telex Institute, we are into trainings, and we have been doing work with Roche since several years. But come end of 2020, we were all sitting at home having nothing to do. So our, you know, at that time, I think we had about 150 people and all sitting at home, no seminars. And we were also in crisis mode. And it was tough.
Had a lot to do. We had to change the whole way how we get things done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had to change everything. We had an enormous workload. So that was a little bit different to most people around us.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can well imagine. And so what we did after a couple of days of shock, we called our clients and we said, look, we are sitting at home and we have nothing to do. But if you want, we can help your staff and we can do resilience programs, meditation programs. And we offered it free of cost because we said we have nothing to do. let's just help the world. And what happened then, Barbara, that brought us back to a space of also purposefulness in an extent which I had never seen. And we started to enjoy work more than ever. We loved it. The team cohesion increased. And Roche actually at that time said, well, it's nice that you're doing that for our people, but don't you need also money for it? We said, yeah, okay, yeah, pay us. It's fine. And in that time, when the first COVID test then was established, we did 3 times a day mindfulness, breathing, relaxation, stress management sessions for exactly these teams which were producing that test. And it was amazing to see and feel the spirit of the people at that time in the organization.
Yeah.
And an incredible achievement.
I also remember that the colleagues, Diagnostics has a large site in Mannheim in Germany.
Yeah.
And as the tests were so much on demand, I remember that colleagues who did have completely other jobs came in for packaging, because it was so important that the tests that came in get out as fast as possible, and everyone came and helped everyone else.
Now, Barbara, I'm trying to understand. I can see you in school socializing more, being maybe not so interested in the topic. Then you started to work really, really hard from 8 to 8. You wanted to prove yourself even in mathematics. You got that job at the federal ministry and you were appreciated. You moved from one to the next really very significant leadership position. And from outside, and that's something that I find very interesting in general, from outside, then that looks sometimes, when we look at LinkedIn, just like a success stories from A to Z. But I'm sure you had hard times, you must have been falling once in a while. And I believe leadership is, life in general is very much not just about winning, but about standing up, managing ourselves in the difficult times. How did that look for you? Did you experience, or which were your tough times, and how did you get through those?
I can clearly describe that. Yeah. I was working for 9 years at Fujitsu Siemens, and I was running the communications and the marketing function there.
Yeah.
And then I became the 5th new CEO in 9 years. I did not become.
Yeah.
We had the 5th new CEO in 5 years. Mm. Yeah. And we did not come very well along with each other, which I think is fair, right?
Yeah.
You know,
this is
what communicators risk anyway, that you a CEO needs to be able to select his or her communicator. You know, that is without any doubt. So we did not come along well. And we agreed that I'm going to stop working for Fujitsu Siemens. And unfortunately, that was in 2006, 2007, and you probably remember that this was in the middle of the financial crisis. And I had completely underestimated how impossible it is to get a new communications job. No one in the world was asking for communicators. Yeah. They were asking for people to help them survive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I built my own little business for 1.5 years. And then I got asked to go to SAP.
And these
1.5 years were pretty tough, right?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have any experience in running my own business.
Yeah.
That was actually really good, because I now know how to do that.
Yeah.
But then I was selected by SAP to become the communications head for one of the co-CEOs. They had this interesting a construct, which was 2 CEOs for one company. Very interesting. And I was the direct communicator to Jim Snabe, who was then one of the 2 co-CEOs.
Yeah.
And that brought me actually back into the corporate life.
Yeah.
And I then also understood how much I enjoy working in a team, just other than someone who is not... who's a lonely fighter. I'm not so much a lonely fighter, right? You know, I get energy from people.
And when you had to go through these 1.5 years, and in general in these times when it's difficult, from where would you say do you get your energy? Because even now that we're sitting together and it's the end of a business day, I can feel your energy, your liveliness. Where do you, let's say...
I'm like that.
You're like that? You get up in the morning?
I don't think about these things, you know. I just get things done.
All right.
you know, when you get up in the morning and said, am I excited today to go to the office? That is a waste of space, this question. You know, you have a job, you get paid for the job, get the job done, right? If you don't want that, do something else. Yeah. And I always wanted this, right? Yeah. You know, I think leadership is more responsibility than rights.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you get a higher payment. Mm. You get other things that you might like or not like, but you're well equipped. Yeah. And then comes responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. You are responsible for solving problems. And I had at Roche, I had an advisor who said, as higher you're up in the hierarchy, as bigger the problems are that you need to solve. And don't complain about being there to solve problems. That is the job.
Yeah.
So accept that probably 95% of your time, you don't have the bright and shiny things. What you have is solve the problems.
Yeah. Hmm? A very powerful concept to say that leadership is about responsibility and not just the rights. And it almost seems to me that many of the global leaders take it exactly the other way around. Leadership has something which entitles me to get.
I saw actually many colleagues in my business life who were not as egocentric, that they were defining the world out of their own perspective. I think most of them are really, really dedicated to the organization they're working for, to the purpose of the organization they have. I have seen many of those, many more than the egocentrics who think that the world turns around them. It does not, you know. It does really not.
It doesn't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. That's a message of hope for sure.
No, I think it's underestimated.
The
burden is a little bit underestimated that these people have, and also the dedication that most of them have. You are not going to succeed when you don't have the dedication.
Yeah. Now, on that aspect of resilience and self-management, which, as you know, is very dear to me, it almost seems, when I hear you describing yourself, that most of the time you're truly connected to yourself and you feel that energy, which gives you the ability to enjoy daily life. Is that so? Or do you have moments where you recharge by going, let's say, for walks, for fitness, singing or whatever? Like, how do you recharge your batteries? It just happens or...
No, I have always been a very, I think I have been a very efficient worker because I like other things as well.
All right. Yeah.
You know, I like going out for dinner with friends. I like spending time with my husband. I like partying.
Yeah.
I like doing sports. I like holidays. I like all kinds of things. And working efficiently enables me to have more time for the other parts of the life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually never wanted to spend more time at work than I absolutely needed to because the rest of my life is as valuable as my working life. But I think the two things need to match. Huh?
They need to match.
Yeah.
And would you say you have the gift then to turn around and let go?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, even if things went really wrong one day, I can go home and say, okay, what do we do now and how do we enjoy our day? You know, you don't want your family to suffer about what you have experienced throughout a day. So it's by the way, it's not worth it. You know, you want to go home. You don't want to spend your whole, you don't want to have your head focused on something that is not going to help you solve issues.
Yeah.
You don't want your whole family to suffer because you are not in good shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to be present and I'm going to be problem solving tomorrow morning again, but not tonight.
Is that something you have been consciously, let's say, practicing and establishing in your life?
Or? Not practicing. That was coming also pretty naturally.
Natural to you.
Yeah.
And by my observation,
I was practicing naturally.
Yeah, you were practicing it naturally. And by my observation, that's for most of the people a tough point. I mean, if we look at statistics, 40% of Swiss and German population have sleeping problems, which is a clear sign of not being able to switch off. many people carry really not just work back home, but they carry also whatever's going on at home back to work, and just the ability to be present is a gift. You have it, but what do you do then as a leader, having that gift with people around you which are struggling maybe with work-life balance, with their resilience, with their ability to cope?
Yeah, work-life balance is such a thing, you know, that can be interpreted like everything, you know.
Of course.
I don't know, your work-life balance is probably something else than my work-life balance, no doubt, right?
You know, why I'm asking it is that I have observed that sometimes leaders who have that naturally can almost not relate to other people who don't have it. They, like, you know, we admire leaders who come into the room every morning charged. But if you don't yourself feel charged, what do you do? How did you manage that gap when you observed it with others? You might have had colleagues who have that same sense of enthusiasm and energy, and you will have worked with people who kind of struggled, right? How did you manage those?
You know, I think I know that life can be tough. You know, every one of us has difficult parts in our life, and my difficult parts were mainly driven from personal situations, because these are so much more impactful on everyone than business situation, right? And I hope that I have always shown respect for people struggling.
Yeah.
I think it's important to talk about it. Mm. I think it's important to find solutions or to give room for solutions. I know that I'm blessed that I have this level of energy all the time, and that I have this resilience. Yeah. I think this is how you call it.
Yeah.
Some people told me that I have a really incredible high level of resilience.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can train it, right? You can
Yeah.
You can really say, okay, what am I going to do tonight? I'm not just going to sit at home on my sofa and I'm going to think about what happened to me today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instead, I go and do some sports, or and I go with my friend, go do some shopping, or I go to a bar, or I go to a football game, or I watch a stupid film. There are lots of things you can do to disconnect your brain from what was going on.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the exact same situation can be always seen from a variety of perspectives.
Yeah.
And the human nature is actually made first of all being fearful.
Yeah.
So something happens, and then we automatically think about, ooh, what a threat. What am I going to do? I'm afraid. I don't know what to do anymore.
Mm.
And fear is a very bad advisor.
Yeah.
Because it limits you in the openness of your thinking.
Yeah.
It is not giving you the opportunity to use all your resources. It's not good. It's not good for you. It's not good for the problem solving.
Yeah.
So I read a book, I don't know, 30 years ago, where I can translate the sentence really, but it made me think a lot about it. It was saying, when you realize that you are acting motivated by fear, stop going on and ask yourself actively, where's the hope in this situation? Once in a while you have to really think hard to find the hope, right? But when you there's probably almost nothing where you can't find hope other than when you're really sick and you know this is going towards the end, right? But in almost any other situation, there's at least a little bit of hope possible.
Yeah.
And when you start refocusing your thinking away from fear to hope, then I think this is a very good advice to turn around to a positive, constructive, moving on mindset instead of remaining into your hole. We are not going to get out just watching your fears.
Yeah. I think that's a very important aspect for our global society, because I think all the news that at the moment they're exposed to can exactly bring up more fear and less hope.
Yeah, but it's an individual decision. You know, yes. We are all fearful. Yeah, once in a while, some more, some less. We all have fears, but it is an explicit decision, and recognition. Okay, what I'm doing now is driven by fear. Let me stop doing that. It is driven by my childhood behavior, not me as an adult.
Yeah.
So how do I stop this? And this is a thinking process. This is a decision-making process.
Yeah.
This is not coming naturally.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is, how do you move from the dark to the bright side of the moon?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the question.
Yeah.
And how do you influence it yourself? No one is going to do it for you. Yeah. No one. Yeah. And I try to make my people and my team think this way and say, okay, let's assume that there's something that can go right.
Yeah.
What do we do then?
Yeah. I'm sure this reflection 30 years ago has perfectly equipped you even furthermore to deal with crisis. Now,
it has equipped me to stay mentally and physically healthy.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So I don't. I was really lucky throughout my life because I did never really face, knocking on wood, any serious diseases.
Yeah.
But I do believe that the mental health piece drives the physical health piece as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Barbara, we know today that, let's say, that the latest AXA report, insurance report, says 1/3 of European population is suffering from mental sickness, not just absence of mental health, but mental sickness. And maybe we can do an exercise, therefore, together. What would you say, if we think through the global scenario, beginning of 2026, and all the possible reasons to experience fear, right, with the wars going on, etc. What would you say could be the hope we see in what's going on? If you now look at the world, just, it would be nice to think through it.
So first of all, nothing lasts forever, huh?
Yeah.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Which is good. You should never exclude that other people are capable to learn as well.
Yeah. Huh?
But what I was talking about was your individual decision.
I
was not talking about the geopolitical things. And I think everyone who focuses on how can I do things right is going to contribute to a better moving on of the world.
Yeah.
You know, I think we cannot wait until the big problems are being solved.
Yeah.
We need to do something in our own surrounding, at our own work, in our own family, and make sure that things are good there, because this is determining how people feel. You know, they're not always looking at the big things in the world. What they want is a good family, a good relation, a pretty healthy and a pretty wealthy life. And if that works, then things are good.
Yeah.
And then you can still have room for concerns about everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not helpful, you know. I'm not responsible for all the problems in the world. I'm responsible for the problems I can solve.
Yeah. I just think, based on what you just said, it's so wonderful also, I think, and it's a responsibility of a leader or of the media also to share hope, although it's an individual choice what somebody would like to hope or
believe
in. By
the way, that is a very interesting question. Yeah. What is the job of journalists?
Yeah.
As you mentioned, media. Yeah. And you know, this is closely connected. My understanding of journalism is closely connected to democracy, because it is the fourth power, right?
Mm.
I do believe journalists do a great job when they disclose things that go wrong.
Yeah.
And organizations should not complain about journalists doing a good job.
Yeah.
Or other people disclosing something they should not have disclosed. What they should complain about, that if there's something that can be criticized, that it was done wrong. And I really admire those journalists who went on, even though it might have had negative impact for them than looking backwards.
Yeah.
But that's their job.
Barbara,
they're not there to praise us, by the way.
Barbara, even in this discussion, I can feel so much energy and your sharpness, alertness.
You want some water?
Yes, I would love to. Thanks a lot. And yet it was so that end of January 2026, you left Roche. So what's up on your agenda now?
So I left Roche for one reason, because at one point in time, you've got to go, right?
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing. You know, everyone is asking me, what are your plans then? Or what were your plans for afterwards? And I said, you know, the great thing is no plans.
Yeah.
I always had to plan, and then there were no plans. And it falls into place, you know, doing traveling more than I did before, or just doing nothing is a very brilliant experience. What is also great is, you know, getting up in the morning and asking yourself, so I have no plans today, what do I want to do? And then just do it. It gives you a totally new experience, because you're not bound to a pretty tight schedule. So, but that's not the only thing I'm doing. What I'm also doing is I'm consulting individuals or organizations in communications. Yeah. I enjoy that a lot. It keeps me kind of connected to the business world and gives me the opportunity to enjoy the freedom I have now. And I think this is probably the best of two worlds, and that is a great advantage that you can enjoy by getting older.
And given what you have to share with the world, your vast experience and how the world is going with all the crises, I'm sure there is no shortage of demand. So I wonder how many days you will really have where you can
I'm going to limit this. You know, I know that my husband is actually a little bit skeptical about it, but I'm going to limit it.
You're going to limit it.
And so my optimal month or year is like 50-50.
50-50. Mm. Okay.
Which is much more than I had before.
Yeah, that sounds great. Now, many will be wondering, listening to you, you know, I think all of us, everybody feels a certain potential, certain things we would like to express, certain things we believe we could maybe achieve. And I think there's always a delta. We cannot explore and live all that we feel is in us. Yet, what would you say to those who feel, Barbara, she made it. She sits there so content, confident, has experienced so much, lived her life. What advices would you give, or suggestions would you give to people who feel, I would like to use more of my potential?
That's so easy, you know, just do it.
Yeah.
There's nothing else but doing it. It's the Nike thing, right? Just do it. Don't wait, and don't wait until someone comes and allows you to do something. By the way, there's also one other thing I want to talk about. I also believe that we have created a world with so many rules and boundaries, and what is allowed and what is not allowed. I have already at the age, I don't, probably 2 or 3, not really enjoyed boundaries.
2-3 years old.
I have never started enjoying boundaries.
Yeah.
So it makes me being a little bit of a rebel. Whenever someone says this is not possible, I want to prove that it is.
So you proved that
you
can learn mathematics?
Yeah, but that not every rule is relevant.
Yeah. Now,
so I'm really a rule breaker.
Yeah.
You know, I try to squeeze the rules as much as I can.
Yeah. You know, when I in my own personal life, I did an apprenticeship before studying, etc. I did an apprenticeship at Credit Suisse, Schweizerische Kreditanstalt at that time, and I think I was also a rebel. And being a rebel and working at Credit Suisse didn't at that time match so well for me. It was difficult. And as a rebel, you have though shaped a corporate career in organizations that can be maybe sometimes a little bit square, or there's so much governance, there's so much you have to comply with. How did you keep that to yourself and feel comfortable within these structures?
I think, first of all, you have to have respect to everyone else, right?
Yeah. You're
not a bulldozer who goes through a company and says, here I am, I don't care about everyone else.
Yeah.
You have to show respect, you have to show interest. But you have to also, I always understood me also encouraging my people. I said, question this.
Mm.
Who said that this is right?
Mm.
Don't do that. You know, is it helpful? Then do it. Is it not helpful? Discuss it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just question things that don't make sense. And there's so many things that don't make sense. And my most beloved sentence in life is, we don't do this here.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, because they say, who defines who we is?
Yeah.
And who defines that we don't do anything?
Yeah.
And am I included in we because someone else has defined that we don't do things?
Yeah.
No, I'm not part of that we then. Huh? And you have to really, you know, or the other things, this person said that and that person wants that. And I say, how do I combine this? I don't know. You know, not both of them are going to get everything.
Yeah.
Find a compromise.
Yeah.
Hmm? This is also the thing with hierarchies, you know, as soon as hierarchies take over and the thinking stops, it becomes difficult.
Really difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I always try to encourage my people, said, turn on your brain, ask the question, is it good or not? If it's not good, also escalate. You know, I can help you. My other colleagues who are in leadership positions can help you when you cannot achieve it yourself. But don't do things that don't make sense to your point of view just because you're asked to do them.
Yeah.
It might not be helpful.
Yeah.
It might not be helpful for the organization. It might not be helpful for you. It might not be helpful for your customers. Question things.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is, we are here. So the only thing that we have to offer, most of us have to offer to our employer, to our company, to our organization, is our brain.
Yeah.
And why do we allow ourselves to shut down the brain? Because we think we get asked to do something that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my experience actually is when you have good facts, when you have good arguments that most people are listening to a better way, and then you probably come up with a better idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you, it's not enough to say no. You have to also say, what do we do instead?
Yeah.
Hmm? You can train that as well. You can train that to say, okay, I'm not just the problem describer, but I'm the problem solver.
Yeah.
And I never would go to my boss and say, can I describe a problem to you? No.
You will just...
I would describe a problem, but then say, but I have an idea how we solve it.
How we solve it.
Hmm?
Yeah.
And as long as I don't have that...
You don't show up.
Continue thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's very, very powerful, because as an organization grows and the structures become naturally more important, I think many people stop actually thinking and using their brain. And that could be then determine, let's say, the effectiveness or the productiveness or the performance of an organization. So we do need to cultivate that aspect of being a rebel. Maybe quite consciously, really,
yes,
for organizational
but
success.
But that is also a cultural question,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's a cultural question.
Yeah.
You know, when you look in many countries of the world, and by the way, that is something that is connected to democracies,
yeah,
where you are asked to express your opinion,
yeah,
because there's a belief that the whole is more than just the sum of the individuals.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That is what is the difference between democracies and oligarchic or dictatorial structures.
Yeah.
It's not everywhere possible. You know, there are so many societies in the world where, what do women have to say,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
Huh? Seniority actually is decisive.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have to accept that as well. You know, we have to accept cultural differences. The Western world or the European world is not here to tell everyone else what to do. But my belief is democracy, exchange of ideas, discussion, even conflict is going to solve problems more than anything else.
Yeah.
Because the other way, where you are having very hierarchical structures, assumes that everyone in the hierarchy knows better.
Yeah.
Not true. And by the way, I don't know better to do the job of someone in my team. They know their job much better than I do. Yeah. So I should not tell them what to do. I should invite them to do the best in their job.
Yeah.
And they should come to me when I can help them.
Yeah.
But assuming that I'm better in anything they're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not. I'm hopefully better in what I'm doing.
Yeah. And it seems to me, Barbara, that in our times of artificial intelligence, this aspect of being a rebel and therefore also thinking out of the box is absolutely crucially important, because I see a risk of more uniformness coming in through ChatGPT, and just that using that global think tank of the artificial intelligence and questioning that, I think, is important but not easy.
Artificial intelligence is an incredible efficiency raiser, yeah. Right? Incredible. Yeah, that is the first thing that is good. You know, it is taking away all the things that are not really worth thinking about.
Yeah.
But the responsibility of things being right and the responsibility of things being good lies with the individual decision maker, not with AI.
Yeah.
So you still have to have that compass on, should I use it? Should I not use it? Should I change it? Should I reflect on it? It is gaining speed. It is giving you tools that you didn't have before, but you are and you remain responsible. AI is not taking this away from you. Instead, you need to always question what you see, if that is reality or not.
Yeah.
And I had a pretty interesting experience. Is ask AI to write a speech.
Yeah.
You get something, right?
No doubt.
You get something. You give the topic. You say who's the speaker. When is that going to happen? All these kinds of things, and then you get a speech. And my experience is the speech is not wrong.
Yeah.
It also has interesting wordings. Really interesting. Good, actually. Two things are completely missing in those speeches. The one thing is the inspiration.
Not there.
And the other thing is the human prediction. AI does not know what AI does not know. And we have always be aware that the things that are in our head and not yet reflected in the systems are not there. And I think this is a, you know, if we use it that way, then and remind ourselves that responsibility lies with us and continues to lie with us. We take the decision. And I desperately hope that the emotional intelligence is going to remain relevant for this.
Absolutely. That brings us back to something which you described so elegantly as being key in crisis communication, that intuition, right? That inner compass. And I do believe, as so much intelligence is out there, that inner compass becomes even more important. It may be a decisive factor to remain even relevant as a leader. Because if you look back, that's how I describe it to myself, is the first and second industrial revolution changed the meaning of the hands, let's say physical labor. But I think the fourth and now fifth industrial revolution, and the world was dominated by the head, by the cognitive abilities of people, they got the best jobs. But now that is being replaced to a certain degree through artificial intelligence. So what's left? And that might be that dimension of heart or intuition, and that added benefit of prediction and creativity that a human being can bring to the table if we cultivate it, though.
Yes, and individualism.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, you will be able to create or to even to produce almost anything with artificial intelligence. Yeah. But you're not never going to get anything really, really, really special or individual.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's going to be mass production. That's going to be very similar everything. Even if it's great, it's not individual. For sure not.
Yeah.
And I'm not a good enough expert in the field to say what is going to happen. There can be concerns. I'm specifically concerned about the future of young people in business life, because what they do at the beginning of their career can pretty easily be replaced by AI. So we need to find concepts on how do we bring young people into the job and how do we ensure that they move faster to very intelligent work that cannot be replaced by AI. And that's a big concern I have. I do not believe in the society of not working and just enjoying life. That's not, that I cannot believe that this is going to ever happen. But we don't have the concepts in space yet. So we need in place yet. We need to really start thinking about what do we do, and believing that you give everyone an amount of money and that people are going to do something with it that's reasonable. I don't believe in that concept. Yeah. Absolutely not.
There might be a very important aspect of purpose really missing there. And then, so what? Why do I live? Why do I exist?
Right, exactly.
What do I strive for? What do I do?
Yeah. Yeah. What do I do? You know, yeah. I'm probably going to live, the next generation is probably going to live even longer than we do. And when I look at my parents who are who live and lived beyond the 90s, that, you know, that is, I don't think that living long is the higher value than living
good
and with great purpose.
Absolutely. Hmm? Yeah.
So if I had to choose, I would always go to the purposeful and good life instead of the too long life.
Yeah, long good living.
I don't know if I would even use the word long. You know, I'm of course glad that I'm still healthy, but that I hopefully have quite some more years in front of me. But quality is defined by the meaningfulness of your life and not by the length of your life.
Yeah. And I'm sure with that message, and also with what you have to offer and what you have found in your own life in terms of that connection to your intuition, listening to your inner voice, that rebelliousness which you maintained in such a...
Well, my mom suffered a lot about it. a lot.
Yes, your mom might have been suffering a lot from it, and you added a lot of value to many organizations with it as well. I think and helping other people to find and kindle that within themselves is something really, really important. I'm sure many will seek your advice. I wanted to conclude, Barbara, with a reflection. If, for example, now tonight you would walk through the beautiful city of Basel,
and which you, I'm going to do,
which you're going to do, and then you walk there, and in front of you suddenly you see the 20-year-old Barbara very clearly. She stands there smilingly in front of you. It's your own young self. What would you tell your young old self as a, let's say, something you have learned already and could be shared? And with that,
I would just say go on. Do what you know. There's nothing wrong with you.
There's nothing wrong with you.
Which, by the way, is something that everyone should think about him or herself, you know. If you do the right things, you know, there's of course some moral and ethical boundaries, right, that you need to respect. But as long as you stay in a reasonable value system, and as long as you want to achieve something, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, I had so far a wonderful life. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Barbara. What a beautiful conclusion. There's nothing wrong with you. And I wish everyone else of our listeners that they can feel the same about themselves and the people around them, because that really changes the quality of our life. Thanks for a really inspirational discussion.
Thank you,
Barbara.
I really enjoyed it.
Yes, I enjoyed it too very much. And thanks to all of you listening in and viewing the podcast. Don't miss up to sign up and stay tuned. It's always a joy to be with you. All the best.